my focus, both my undergraduate degrees, my graduate degrees, my work for Congress, my work with the Institute for Policy Studies, have all been focused on policy. Public policy has been my frame of trying to understand the world and understand how I can help make it a better place. And in writing the Bush Agenda, what I did was looked at four corporations, Halliburton, Lockheed Martin, Bechtel, and Chevron, and their relationship to the Bush administration and relationship to the administration's policies and its agenda. And in working on that book and in working on issues most primarily around the war and around the war in Iraq, I came increasingly to see the critical importance of oil and oil corporations, the individual actors that are the individual oil companies, and how little we know about them. How little has been written about them as actors, as policy stakeholders. And how little we truly appreciated and understood their role in directing key public policy decisions and choices, guiding the economy, climate change, military policy, and the like. And I looked at this history and I found that really there had not been a critical analysis of these companies. And there have been lots of great books, don't get me wrong, particularly on the geopolitics of oil, the sort of larger issues around oil and oil interests and the environment. There is the classic book, The Prize, by Daniel Yergin, written in 1991, a book I use and quote in my book. But Yergin, first of all, the book was written in 91, and a lot has changed since then. But also Yergin, I think, would be the first to say he's not a critic of the industry. He is part of the oil industry. And there has not been a critical look at these companies since 1975, since Anthony Sampson wrote the classic book, The Seven Sisters. And I set out essentially to fill this void of critical need and critical information, and to look at the individual companies, who they are, where they came from, what their agenda is, where they intend to go in the future, how they intend to get there, and what that means for us. And I also entered this by looking at this, what to me seemed to be a confusing moment in policy and activism, where we in many ways are winning on fronts around issues such as climate change. So for example, we now live in a time when someone like Governor Sarah Palin, who had been a climate denier for most of her career, has now said, you know, not only is climate change a real phenomena, but I see it, I see its impacts on my state, I see it harming my state. And I have to say, if anyone has been to Alaska, which I have, it's pretty hard to be in Alaska and not see the effects of climate change. So she says this is a real phenomena. That's a big shift from when the Bush administration entered and sought very aggressively to promote the concepts of climate change denial. And most Americans by far, if you look at polls, are not only believe that climate change is a phenomena, but are deeply worried about it. Also similarly on the war, we recently reached the point in the Iraq war where more Americans oppose this war and believe that it should never have taken place than have ever felt that way during a war in U.S. history. The previous record had been set with the Vietnam War at 72% of Americans. Now 75% of Americans believe that this war should never have happened. Yet we write policies that continue the war, yet we write policies that significantly lead to increases in climate change. And why are these simultaneous? Why is our policy not matching our politics? And I increasingly came to see these actors as one of the primary reasons why. And so what I look at, first of all, is the subtitle of the book. So the title of the book is The Tyranny of Oil. If anyone, all you have to do is open the book to find where I got the title from, but I'll tell you anyway, and some of you may know. It comes from a speech that Barack Obama gave when he accepted the, when he won the Iowa caucus. And he said, I will be the president who ends the tyranny of oil once and for all and brings the Iraq war to an end. One sentence. And I was very touched by that phrase, and I thought it encapsulated a lot. My subtitle, though, is The World's Most Powerful Industry, and then What We Must Do to Stop It. So I am equating here power, where I get the world's most powerful industry. I am equating profit with power. And what I did was look at the largest oil companies in the world, which also happen to be the largest corporations in the world, by profit measure. So Walmart is the largest corporation in the world by revenue. It is the largest employer in the world. They exist everywhere. They sell a lot of profits, a lot of products. They generate a lot of revenue. But their profits are less than a third of ExxonMobil's. And ExxonMobil is the second largest corporation in the world based on revenue, but hands down, far and away, the most profitable corporation ever in the history of the world. In fact, ExxonMobil became the most profitable corporation in the history of the world in 2003. Adjusted for inflation, period, the most profitable corporation ever. It then topped those profits in 2004, topped them in 2005, 2006, 2007, 2008, such that last year ExxonMobil made $40 billion in pure profit. Now, I think most of us are familiar with that statistic, but that's just one of the companies. So the companies that I'm looking at are the largest companies in the world, but also, in particular, the largest oil companies operating within the United States. So those are ExxonMobil, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, BP, Shell, Valero, and Marathon. These companies, when you add up their profits, and I did, and it was very boring because I did it for many, many years, and I did it across all industries to try and find out if there is any comparison. Lo and behold, there is not. If you add up the profits, and this begins in about the year 2000, and that's an important year, which I'll come back to. If you add up the profits of the defense industry, pharmaceuticals, healthcare, agriculture, entertainment, what are other industries that people might think their profits might challenge big oils? Hold the banks over here with a pin in it. Insurance. I was going to say we're in Seattle. Come on. Telecom, high tech, software, right? No, nothing, not even close, nothing remotely close. I ran out of defense contractors, trying to get enough defense contractors to even come close to the six most profitable oil companies. The only industry that came close were the nation's banks. And we all know what's happened to the banks of late. However, made my point really well. Ding, hello. However, the two U.S. investment banks that have survived the financial crisis are Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley. Now, who knows what these two companies have in common? Who's been listening to me on the radio? Oil. So these are two banks that have morphed into oil companies. That's how they have survived the crisis. Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs own oil fields. They own tankers. They own pipelines. They also happen to own the exchange on which crude oil futures are traded, but I will get back to that as well. So it's the oil industry, guys. Now, why do I care so much about profit, and why do I equate it with power? Okay, first, a little economics 101. Because when the CEOs of ExxonMobil and ConocoPhillips and Chevron come before the U.S. Senate, and the U.S. Senate says to them, you earn lots of profits, and we think that's bad. Let me take this off. And they say, yes, we earn lots of profits. You're right. But we have an extremely expensive industry. We have to spend a lot of money on exploring for, producing, developing, refining, selling gasoline. So we need these big profits. Now, you know, hopefully someone in this audience has taken a math class or an economics class, has been through junior high. And if you have done one of those things, you would know that profit is what you end up with after you've taken in your revenue and then you've expended all of your expenditures. You've done the research, you've done the exploring, you've done the producing, you've spent your capital. What's left is profit. The profit is huge. It's enormous. There's no comparison. Why I am concerned about it is what they then are doing with it. What they are doing with it that I am most concerned about is using it to fundamentally alter our political debate over these critical issues. Now, I look at, there's a chapter in the book which I continually refer to as the democracy chapter, which it's not. It's more the anti-democracy chapter. It's the way big oil spreads its money around. And there are the ways that I think most of us are familiar with, the most obvious ways, which is campaign giving. So if you listen to me on the Stephen Scherr show today, you would know that today, or was it yesterday? I can't keep track. Yesterday, 2008 became the most expensive presidential race for the oil and gas industry in the history of presidential politics. McCain and Palin just surpassed the record amount of money taken in from the oil and gas industry, the record set in 2000 by Bush and Cheney. They just took in about $2 million from the oil and gas industry. That's in comparison to Obama and Biden's about $500,000. Now, $200 million doesn't sound like a lot when I just mentioned ExxonMobil's $40 billion in profits, right? Campaign giving is a minor, little, teeny tiny drop in the bucket of what they do with their money. So, but first of all, just to finish this point, on campaign giving, essentially the oil and gas industry is a Republican industry. Overall, this year they've given about 77% of their money to Republican candidates across the board. That's the typical percentage for elections. It gets more concentrated within companies, so ExxonMobil tends to give about 90% of its money to Republicans. Chevron's a little more liberal, giving about 82%. Chevron's based in California. We have a lot of Democrats in California, so they give to more Democrats. And that's pretty much the ratio within the big companies. The big place where they spend their money isn't on campaigns, though. The reason why is that we watch that, those numbers, right? They're public, they're limited, and people pay attention. The next big place where they spend a lot of money is on lobbying. And ExxonMobil, for example, alone spent 14 times more money, 14 times more lobbying the federal government between 1989 and today than it spent on giving money to campaigns. 14 times more. Now, I worked on Capitol Hill. I've worked for two members of Congress. I can personally attest to the absolute permeation of this industry. They're always there. They're always lobbying. They're always promising, you know, greener fields in your future as a staffer, as an elected official, as a bureaucrat, if only you will hear the good news and follow the will of the oil industry. And I give an example in the book of Senator Nichols, I'm blanking on his first name, Don Nichols, who was the head of Key Energy Policy Committee for a very, very long time. And he received a fair amount of money from the oil industry. It doesn't look like a lot on the books, but he received a fair amount of money from the oil industry when he was a candidate. When he left the Senate and founded his own lobbying firm, he has now taken in 10 times, 20 times, 30 times more money from the industry. The payoff, the cash payoff came when he started lobbying on behalf of the industry after leaving the Senate. But that's also just one way that they influence policy. Another is by funding other groups to influence policy. So the largest lobbying group in front of the U.S. Congress, hands down by far, is the United States Chamber of Commerce. Chamber of Commerce spends twice as much money as the next largest lobbying force, the U.S. Medical Association, the American Medical Association, the Chamber of Commerce spends twice as much money lobbying. Now, the Chamber is increasingly looking like, sort of following the model of the banks, looking like an oil lobbying body. They're getting more and more money from the oil industry. Their agenda more and more directly models that of the oil industry, and they are essentially now a lobbying force for the oil industry. And that's not just at the federal level, but state level and the local level as well. Then there are groups like the American Petroleum Institute, the leading lobby body for the oil industry. Then there are what we call the front groups. So, for example, I think for many folks it was a little perplexing to see how the whole debate over climate change unfolded, particularly over the 90s and the beginning of this decade. And one of the things that we've learned is that, and I'm going to blow these numbers out of proportion, but let's say there were three scientists who claimed that climate change wasn't a real phenomenon. And then there were 3 million who said that there were. But somehow these three, their voice was equated with the 3 million. And somehow it seemed like there was a debate. Well, one of the reasons why was because that ExxonMobil alone was spending millions, about $50 million, supporting, through front groups, those three climate deniers. But you didn't know that it was ExxonMobil supporting their science. And this is a way that they really fundamentally impact local politics. And this is really relevant right now when many states are facing lots of ballot measures that deal with the oil industry. So I tell the story in the book of Proposition 87 in California, which we introduced 2 years ago. Now, California is the third largest oil-producing state in the country. The largest oil companies all operate there: Exxon, Chevron, Shell, Occidental. We are also one of the richest states in the country in terms of the wealth that resides in our state, but we are a state that is totally financially bankrupt, right? You may know that we just barely escaped asking the U.S. Treasury for a $7 billion bailout for the state because we are so broke. That might have something to do with our governor, but we can't blame the governor. It's not Schwarzenegger's fault. It is the fault of the decision, essentially, by the state of California to renounce the concept of taxation. We basically don't tax the wealthy and we don't tax our corporations. So we have no money. And so what we tried to do through a ballot initiative was just try to implement what's called a severance tax. When you sever the resource out of the earth, so in this case, oil, when oil companies took oil out of California, just took it out of the ground, we wanted to tax them a teeny tiny little bit, just a little bit of money. It became the most expensive ballot initiative in the history of the United States. The oil industry spent $100 million to defeat the initiative, and they were always ready to spend three times more, four times more, five times more. But, and I quote the communications director, Youssef Raab, who ran the supporting campaign for Proposition 87, and he said, the problem was that when we set out to do battle against big oil, Californians had no idea that big oil was our adversary. They were shielded by front groups, by independent research. There was a report that was done by a group called LEGC, and that doesn't stand for anything. It's LEGC. And LEGC put out an independent analysis of Proposition 87. And it concluded with the one thing that scares Americans more than climate change, than war, than just about anything. I wish it was jobs. Gas prices. That gas prices would go up. Now, this is, I'm belittling this and I shouldn't. The price of gas is obviously an absolutely critical issue for many, many, many people. People in this country choose between driving their children to school and eating breakfast, depending on the price of gas. It's a very critical issue. However, LEGC put out this study demonstrating that if we passed Proposition 87, gas prices would go up in the state. And when this ballot initiative was introduced, initially, 65% of Californians said it was a great idea. 5 months later, it was voted down, and the reason that Californians gave for voting it down was they were afraid that their gas prices would go up. Guess who funded the LEGC study? Chevron, Exxon, Occidental. But we didn't know that until afterwards. Now, put a pin in the concept of gas prices, because I'm going to get back to that. It is an absolute fallacy that the gas prices would have gone up. It is also, though, the scare tactic that's being used in this election and is used in almost always in almost every initiative, that your gas prices are going to go up if you do anything to rein in this industry. But I use Proposition 87 as a case study to demonstrate the influence of the industry on policymaking. Now, we are in an incredibly unique moment in political history. Everybody is talking like a populist, right? Governor Palin, Senator McCain. Senator McCain opened both of his debates with, both of the last two debates with statements about the need to get the fat cats on Wall Street, to pay their fair share to the working people, on Main Street. Governor Palin repeats these lines in almost every speech that she gives. At the beginning of the 2008 election cycle, Senator Edwards was the one who was called the populist. Then Senator Obama was called the populist. Then Senator Clinton was called the populist. Now everybody's a populist. There's a reason why they're all talking like populists, and they are. Because we are in such a similar economic moment to when the populist movement was at its height. So I begin this book with what I consider to be a success story, a story to get us feeling good, even though it looks so ominous on the cover. And that is the story of the populist movement of the 1860s and the 1880s and the 1890s. Now, at this time, following the Civil War, corporations across the United States were permitted to merge, gobble up competitors, push out anyone who might stand up against them, and mega trusts were formed. And the trusts became so economically huge that they controlled government decision-making. And they became unregulatable. And people all across the country organized. They organized in populist movements, they organized in progressive movements, they organized in revolutionary movements, and while many sought revolution, what they got was regulation. The very first regulations on corporate activity in the United States, the 8-hour workday, the 40-hour work week, the very first campaign finance laws in the United States, and antitrust law. Now, it's been said that if Standard Oil was called the Standard Oil Corporation instead of the Standard Oil Trust, that we would have anti-corporation laws in the United States. But we have our antitrust laws because the focus was Standard Oil, the largest corporation in the world, the largest oil corporation in the world, and the corporation that had taken over government decision-making. So the people organized. They convinced the Democrats. They convinced the Republicans. They changed state law. They changed federal law. They ultimately convinced the Supreme Court to use antitrust law. And the principle of antitrust was corporations should not be allowed to get so big that their power dominates the government's ability to regulate them. And they used the antitrust laws to, in 1911, break up Standard Oil into 34 separate pieces. Now, it's taken about 100 years, but those pieces have been allowed to come back together. I use the imagery in the book. Have any of you seen the movie Terminator 2? Yeah, the water guy, the liquid metal guy. So the bad guy is made of liquid metal. And when you blow him up, he goes into little tiny pieces, but the liquid metal slowly congeals back together to form a guy again. This is Standard Oil and the oil companies, right? So they're broken up into 34 separate parts. Well, I go through a lot of history in the book, and the point of is to go through history. You can read it. When we get to the 1980s, there's just a fundamental new approach to antitrust law, and that is that it is no longer the philosophy of the government that we should regulate corporate activity, and that it is no longer the philosophy of the government that we should use antitrust law as a means to pursue larger democratic goals. That antitrust policy should really only be used on issues of prices. If it looks like prices are going to get higher due to a merger, then we will stop a merger from happening. If a company looks like it's controlling prices, then we will break up the company. Otherwise, we don't really care. And that new approach to antitrust policy led to a wave of mega mergers all across the economy. This was the era of the hostile takeover. You know, the movie Wall Street is the like quintessential hallmark of this era. And in the oil and gas industry in particular, we saw mega mergers begin, and this approach towards antitrust continued in the Clinton administration. It was part and parcel of the Clinton administration's larger corporate globalization agenda. Let the companies get big. Let them go where they want to go. It was continued in both Bush administrations, or Bush and then Clinton and then Bush. And the result was, in the oil and gas industry alone, 2,600 mergers just in the oil and gas industry just since 1991. Now, the big ones that we know about, right, are Exxon and Mobil, the two largest post-breakup pieces of Standard Oil, allowed to come back together. Chevron purchased Gulf, purchased Texaco, purchased Unocal, one company. ConocoPhillips merged. BP bought Amoco and Arco. Shell is the product of many other smaller mergers, and almost all of these are former Standard Oil pieces. Those are the big mergers. What that has resulted in domestically is mass concentration within the U.S. refining sector and mass concentration within the gas station sector. Essentially, these companies that had been focusing on international controlling the oil all around the world, their oil was nationalized, they turned their attention back to the United States, and they turned formerly unprofitable industries into profitable industries, refining and marketing, selling gasoline. And once they did this, they were able to increase their profits and sort of rebuild their power, which had been fundamentally weakened by the nationalizations of their oil. They are, over the course of the 80s and over the course of the 90s, consolidating, getting more powerful, locking in their control of the domestic U.S. market. Now they turn their attention to crude. And what they do, in 2000, is, first of all, in 2000, up until now, they spend more money than they've spent on any election in U.S. history getting Bush and Cheney elected. Then they, after, and I actually say getting Bush appointed. So after Bush is appointed, and in the lame duck period before he takes office, the oil companies and the banks and Enron turn to Phil Gramm in the U.S. Senate. And they say, Phil, buddy, we've regained about 13% of the world's oil. Now, that's good, but it's not great. And we feel like we could make a lot more money from our oil if you would help us out. And one way that you could help us out is if you would just get the government off our back when we trade in crude. And Phil said, cool. And he slipped in the Commodity Futures Modernization Act into an 11,000-page omnibus appropriations bill that was signed by President Clinton and put into law and included what has now famously and forevermore been known as the Enron loophole. And what that did was allow certain energy trades to take place on exchanges completely unregulated by the U.S. government. The first casualty was the West Coast energy crisis. In 2000, Enron set up its own, very originally named, Enron Online. Enron Online was Enron's very own electricity exchange, completely unregulated. We in California, and you guys here a little bit, turned over our electricity markets to Enron. Very wise decision on our part. Enron, then, we have now since learned, and I quote the Enron energy traders in here, saw this as a vast playground of unregulated exchanges on which they could do whatever they wanted. And I have them quoted saying, we know the things we were doing were unethical, we know they were morally reprehensible, but we also knew that nobody would catch us. So, seriously, that's what they said. So they created a false scarcity of electricity in my state, pushed electricity out of the state, which led to rolling blackouts, which led to our two largest public utilities going bankrupt, which led to businesses closing, people losing their jobs. Enron's profits shot up, but then, of course, Enron imploded upon its own greed. And we found out that they were manipulating the market. and Enron collapsed. But the Enron energy traders lived on. And they now work for Chevron, for BP, for Goldman Sachs, for Morgan Stanley, and for their own hedge funds. And they are now doing with crude what they did with electricity. Because also in 2000, Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, BP, Total, and Shell founded their own exchange on which to trade crude, the completely unregulated intercontinental exchange, the aptly named ICE. ICE is where crude oil is now being traded, and 2000 is the year when the price of crude began its rapid ascent. But 2006 is the point when it really shot up. And what happened in 2006 was that the number of crude oil futures traded on the ICE surpassed the unregulated ICE, surpassed the number of crude trades traded on the regulated New York Mercantile Exchange. And the price went up, and the oil companies got really, really rich, and they were really happy, and they started using their profits to do lots of nefarious things. So, chapters, I have two chapters in the book which look at where the oil industry wants to go. The first message, not that. First message I want you to take from this talk is that the oil companies intend to remain oil companies. Okay? I had the pleasure of reading through hundreds and hundreds of pages of oil company tax returns. And what I found in this process, in an attempt to find out how much they actually spend on green energy alternatives, because they spend a lot of money on commercials convincing us that they're green, and I figured, considering how much they spend on trying to convince us that they are green energy companies, it would be really easy to find out how much they spend on green energy. Not true. It was quite difficult. I found out, however, that they don't spend money on green alternatives. So the company that spends the most on green energy alternatives is BP. At best, and these were very, very generous estimates on my part so that nobody could say that I was being stingy to the poor old oil companies. At best, BP spent 4% of its total expenditures in 2006 and 2007 on green energy alternatives. You know, that's a real investment, but hardly qualifies the company for beyond petroleum, right? Chevron, about 3% in 2006, closer to 1.8%. The rest of the companies, 0.5%. ExxonMobil, 0 in 2006. Exxon, which used to, I used to love Lee Raymond so much for his honesty. He used to say things in the media like, why on earth would we invest in alternatives? We are the most profitable company in the history of the entire planet. Why would we do anything different? But they got rid of Lee Raymond because he was so honest and frank. And now even ExxonMobil feels that it needs to try and show that it is a green energy company. And it spends a little over 0%. And they do this for two reasons. The first is so that you will think that when you fill up your tank with Chevron gasoline, that you are making an investment in green energy. And it's a good thing that you're filling up your tank with Chevron. They also want you to not try to influence your elected officials to do things like eliminate the subsidies on the oil industry, tax the oil industry, regulate the oil industry, so that the government can take that revenue and invest it in green energy. Because why would we need the government to do that? The oil companies are doing it themselves. And they want you to think that. They also just want you to think really highly of them, because I'm just going to really quickly mention Chevron in particular, which is spending a heck of a lot of money right now on PR. There's a reason why Chevron is spending a lot of extra money on PR. On October 27th, a historic case is going to go to trial in San Francisco. Landmark. Nigerians who have been struggling against Chevron for decades, but in particular in one case for 9 years, who have accused Chevron of mass human rights abuses, including murder, are having their day in court in San Francisco in front of a jury. And every day in that trial, we are going to hear of the atrocities that Chevron is accused of committing in Nigeria. And they really want you to think highly of them while this is happening. They also are about to have a ruling against them in Ecuador for the largest oil spill in the world, all across the Ecuadorian Amazon. And that ruling in Ecuador is about to potentially charge Chevron with $16 billion worth of damages. And Chevron's position on that case, which they really want you to accept, is that what happened in Ecuador stays in Ecuador, and if the Ecuadorian government, if an Ecuadorian judge wants to charge Chevron for $16 billion, well, that's just tough, because they don't have to follow laws in Ecuador, and they're not going to pay. What?
It worked in Alaska.
It did work in Alaska. And so these are two of the reasons why Chevron wants you to think they're really nice. So what they are doing, and what I go through in the environment chapter and in the military chapter, is they believe that they will get what's left of the world's oil. Yes, the world is running out of oil. They get that. But they will get what's left. That we will allow them to burrow through tar, to tunnel into shale, to drill every drill offshore, that we will use our military to secure their access to Africa, to Iran, to Iraq, to Saudi Arabia, that we will make it possible for them to get every last barrel. And each of those barrels is going to be worth more and more money. Yes, the price has gone down now. Yes, we are on the verge or in a major global recession, and demand is going to fall. But unless we do some pretty fundamental changes in our behavior, demand will go back up. Right now, we consume between 4 and 6 barrels of oil for every one that we produce. Oil will go back to $100 a barrel, $150, $300, $500 a barrel. And it will be worth it to them to remain oil companies. So the challenge to us and the question to us is, how far are we going to let them take us down their path? And I propose a bunch of things. But I won't go into all of them right now because, fortunately, I wrote a book. And it's in the last chapter of the book. So just quickly, there's 3 things that I will touch on. The first is, of course, consumption, consumption, consumption. We need to lead by example for the rest of the world. We need to demonstrate that it's possible to leapfrog the oil stage of development. And we need to reduce consumption. We need to invest in public transportation. We need to invest in localized alternatives, green cities, all the great ideas that people have been thinking about for 30 years, 40 years, 50 years. But we need to invest in them and make them happen. We need to reduce our dependence on this product. But then we need to find ways to reduce the political influence of this industry. And one of those tools is a very simple idea that I propose, which is to break up the oil companies. A second idea that I propose is to follow a very successful model used in the 90s against the tobacco industry. And this is a campaign put forward by a group I work with, Oil Change International, calling for the separation of oil and state. That what was done in the 90s was to make it essentially toxic for elected officials to be linked to the tobacco industry. This was an industry that was seen as impenetrable in its power, so dominant, so controlling of a substance to which we were completely addicted that it could do anything it wanted. Well, the relationship to that industry through activism came to be seen as something that elected officials didn't want, and they renounced money from that industry. And lo and behold, we started to regulate that industry. It didn't disappear. We didn't wipe it off the face of the earth, but we did regulate it. Oil, of course, another deadly, toxic substance to which we have developed a deadly addiction. To make it toxic for candidates to be seen as associated with this industry, to call on elected officials to renounce oil industry money. In the case of Obama and Biden, who have raised more money than any candidates in the history of American politics, doubled the record set by Bush and Cheney, that they give back the $500,000 that they've taken from the oil industry as a demonstration that campaign promises will actually become policy reality when the campaigning is over, and that we as individuals will individually pledge to vote for the least oily candidate out there. So thank you all very much.
One thing I couldn't figure out was always I've been worried, very curious about this is, duh, how come oil companies don't understand that extinction is not profitable?
why don't oil companies understand that extinction isn't profitable? Well, apparently it is.
Well, I'll wave my hand and come up to the microphone. I'm not sure I agreed with your opening remark about Sarah Palin. I think that she continues vociferously and openly to deny that human activity is the driver of most climate change.
Yeah.
And in that, I think that is the position that she took long before she was sought for national office. That leads me to conclude that potential McCain-Palin administration would not really change a lot in climate change policy. After all, if human activity isn't a factor, then there's no amount of money you can throw at orbital changes.
Yeah.
I don't really see a turnaround there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. The position of the McCain-Palin ticket is summarized in three words. Do I have to say what those three words are?
Drill, baby, drill.
Drill, baby, drill, right? We know the approach. So actually, the point that I usually make, and thank you for bringing this up again because I didn't make it, is part of the problem in terms of policy that I see is how anachronistic it can be that we have someone like Governor Sarah Palin who can say, yes, I see that climate change is a phenomenon, yes, I see it impacting my state, and drill, baby, drill, right? That the policy that held in place for 27 years of a moratorium on offshore drilling fell at the same time as we have people like Governor Palin acknowledging that climate change is a real phenomenon. And that, to me, is a hallmark of the power of the industry, right? They convinced us that offshore drilling is a good idea. Public polls actually showed that people thought it was a good idea. Now, don't get me started on offshore drilling because it gets me very excited. So just two things. First of all, I quote a Chevron a specialist in offshore drilling in the book who says, offshore drilling is a total crapshoot. Costs $120 million per hole. They use diamond-encrusted drills. 80% of them in the Gulf are dry holes. Every single hole you drill at 500 feet or deeper releases methane, a greenhouse gas 20 times more greenhouse gas intensive, climate intensive, than CO2. 20 times more. Every hole, dry or with oil, releases methane. The oil industry wants to spend all this money because if they own the fields and they show that they're working them, they get to book the reserves. They get to show that they're theirs. If they book reserves, their stock prices go up. And we don't get any oil, right? Because even the Bush administration says it'll take 10 years before the offshore yields any meaningful oil. But they keep drilling and they keep causing the environmental devastation associated with drilling. And someone like Governor Palin is to say that it's clean, it's a clean process, drilling offshore. And I go into this in the book. But yeah, I mean, yes, of course, this is the heart of the problem, with a perspective that says that human activity does not cause climate change. I just begin there to show that we've won the rhetorical argument, we have absolutely not won the policy argument. And you're right that McCain and Palin sort of embody, that position.
The U.S. Energy Information Administration says that we currently have about 21 billion barrels of oil as reserves. Those oil fields in the United States that are not offshore, in fact, have only been developed to about 30%. I'm aware of efforts in research and development to try to find ways to extract additional oil from proven reserves in the United States that don't require additional offshore drilling.
Mm-hmm.
Where in an integrated resource and energy policy of either administration would you see development of petroleum opportunities as well as other kinds of opportunities that we are spending a lot of time talking about. Would you see that as a reasonable policy to, as part of an integrated policy?
Yeah, we can't just decide tomorrow we're done with oil. This is why I don't call for shutting down the oil companies. This is why I don't, you know, presume to say that this is an easy path that I'm proposing. We will continue to need to, drill, continue to need to use oil. And we need to get oil. However, let me just say in terms of U.S. oil usage, in the United States, we have right now, in particular right now, but have for many, many years, had excess oil stocks. This is the amount of oil out of the ground that's sitting in barrels, out of the ground, in stock. Since 2006, what the oil industry has been doing with the excess stock, increasingly, not exclusively, but increasingly, is exporting it out of the United States, exporting oil and gasoline products out of the United States. The reason why is because they can get more for it elsewhere, and because we have an overabundance here, from their perspective. They have also been choosing, while oil stocks have gone up, gasoline stocks have gone down. So what that means is that they are choosing to refine less of it into gasoline. Why would they do that, you might ask? Perhaps it has something to do with the price that you will pay for gasoline if there is less of it. Now, if we drill more and we propose a policy of drilling more, right now what you're going to do is contribute to stocks of oil sitting in barrels. You will contribute to oil being sent out of the United States. You will contribute to the bottom line of oil companies. But I don't know what you're going to do about energy security in the United States, and I certainly don't know what you're going to do about gasoline prices in the United States, because the decision on gasoline prices is ultimately, the primary determinant of the price of gas is oil. But about 30%, because the oil companies are vertically integrated, they own the field, they own the refinery, they own the gas station, 30%, 30 cents of every dollar is in the hands of the oil companies. And they make profit and loss decisions all along the chain, and they decide how much you'll pay, essentially, for gasoline, and that's how they price it. So one of the phenomena that we see in gasoline pricing is referred to as the rocket and feathers effect. When the price of oil goes up, the price of gasoline goes up like a rocket. We all know that the price of oil is up, so people say, oh, okay, it makes sense that the price of gas would go up as well. When the price of oil goes down, the price of gasoline feathers slowly down. However, what we've seen lately is that when the price of oil went down, most recently, the price of gasoline actually shot down rather speedily. Now, I propose, although I don't know for certain, that that might have a little something to do with the elections. That it is a phenomena that we see around election time, which is that the prices go down, right? Now, what that goes to say is that the oil industry, at the end of the day, controls oil prices. They decide if they want to, for example, right now Chevron just introduced a $15 billion stock buyback program. That's what it's doing with $15 billion of its dollars, buying back its own stock. They choose if they're going to lower your gasoline prices. They choose if they're going to pocket the money and keep it as CEO pay, buy back their stock. They choose what they do. And if they think you won't pay more for gasoline, they won't charge you more for gasoline.
Yeah. I don't know if it's relevant, but the two things that in my mind is the transfer of the liability of offshore drilling platforms and stuff to the government or to the people versus their having the responsibility. And the other is, where does Boondog Pickens fit into all this?
Let me start with Boondog Pickens, because that's more fun. So T. Boone Pickens, how many folks have seen the Pickens Plan TV commercials? Yeah? His book just surpassed mine on energy books in terms of sales. So get out there and buy my book, because that just burns me the wrong way. So T. Boone Pickens made his money in the era of the hostile takeover. He was the expert at finding weak companies, going in, making money, getting out, and that's where he made a lot of his money, and in the oil industry. He knows how to make money off of hot products and resources. So right now, Tebboune is the largest private owner of water in the state of Texas. He's buying up swaths of land in Texas, and in the United States, unique among most countries, the person who owns the land owns the resources under the land, right? So he owns the land, and he owns the water under it. And he is holding on to that oil because water because he knows that water, like oil, is a resource for which demand is going to exceed supply, and those that control it and own it are going to make a hefty profit selling it to those who need it. And he's holding on to that water because he knows that Texas is going to need the water, and he's going to be the guy that's going to own it and sell it. He's also buying that land to be the person who is the purveyor of wind and solar energy, and he is going to sell it at the price that he can, and he's going to make a heck of a lot of money off of it. And that's Tebboune's contribution. Now, I think my response to Tebboune is similar to the idea of, I don't bring up the fact that the oil companies aren't investing in alternatives so that we will try to encourage them to do so. I don't like the way that they've dealt with the resource that they have. I don't like the idea of large corporate actors with the track record that they have controlling the air, the sun, the water, the wind, the land. Because I don't like the way that they've dealt with the resource that they have. And what that says to me, what that says to Tebboune and the like, is that what we really need to focus on is, one, reducing consumption. We simply cannot try to envision a world where we continue to consume the way we do and just replace oil with any other fuel. Because what that leads to is scenarios like what's happening with ethanol, right? We are growing ethanol instead of growing food, and food is more expensive and people can't afford to eat. And we are eliminating vast tracts of rainforest, and we are turning over vast tracts of land to people who are potentially going to, you know, really try and rip us off to make a profit off of those resources. So the only solution that I could offer is, one, we have to reduce consumption, but two, we have to really look at localizing alternatives, right? Small-scale ethanol is okay. Small-scale biofuels are okay. Small-scale wind, small-scale solar, to try as much as possible to localize the ownership and the resource and the use and control of alternatives. Now, that's not a magic panacea. I'm sorry, folks. In this area, there are none. But to me, it seems like a better course to follow than the Tebboune course.
Thank you for being on Democracy Now! I'm an avid watcher, and I'm also an avid reader of the Christian Science Monitor. They heard an article not too terribly long ago stating, and this is that actually the earth is awash in oil.
Mm-hmm.
There's about 5 to 6 trillion barrels.
Mm-hmm.
Took hundreds of years to go through the first trillion. We've almost gone in 100 years through the second trillion.
Mm-hmm.
The third trillion is where we run into problems where the oil is extremely difficult to get at. And just your comments on that. Thanks.
I think that's largely what I've already put forward. So I think the only thing that I would add is we recently reached the point where now more than 50% of the oil that's left in the world is heavy oil. We've essentially gone through most of the easier to get at conventional lighter oil. What's left is heavy oil. What that means, particularly if we pursue the really heavy stuff in the tar sands and the like, that increasingly the oil that we are using is also more polluting oil. So not only is it harder to get at, and more energy intensive to get at, often in the form of the tar sands or shale, but to refine it is a more polluting process. So the number one indicator of where refineries are in the United States is not income, it's race and ethnicity. So communities of color are where refineries are located. The refineries that are left in the United States are refineries, and I go into this in the book, and it's a little late to go into it now, but are refineries that are essentially old, decrepit, have been allowed to run down, have been allowed to not be kept up because it's been cheaper for the oil industry to, instead of building new, clean, efficient, safe refineries, to make do with their old, decrepit, unsafe refineries. And it is the communities of color in the United States, and in addition, most often low-income communities of color, that are bearing the brunt of these policies. Not only are they bearing the brunt of the existing policies that we have on refineries, but as all the refineries across the United States are now in the process of trying to retool the refineries to burn the dirtier, heavier, more polluting crude, the companies are trying to convince us to deal with a loophole written into the Clean Energy Act, the Clean Air Act, that they're not going to increase pollution. Because if it's shown that they are going to significantly increase pollution, then they have to fix the entire refinery and make it clean and safe. So they're going across the country trying to say that when we burn the dirtier, more polluting crude, it's not going to increase pollution. And it is. So another lawsuit against Chevron is one being fought 60 miles from where I live in Richmond, California, which is the home of the Richmond Chevron refinery, which has been there for, the refinery has been there for 100 years. The most recent explosion that we had at the refinery, and we have them often, was from a 30-year-old pipe that they hadn't replaced. And it released this enormous cloud of sulfur, and people received automated phone calls that said, don't go outside, shut your windows and doors, and don't breathe the air, because it's filled with pollutants, and it's all going to be okay anyway. So the communities in Richmond, environmental justice communities, are suing their city council because the city council approved a plan by Chevron saying that they could start burning tar sand oil in Richmond and basically not change anything at the refinery and they wouldn't increase pollution. And now they're being sued by the local communities there. If they win, what those communities are trying to do is put in place essentially a cap that says we won't take the dirty crude. If they win, That's a precedent that refineries can follow all around the country, which is that none of us will take the heavier crude. If nobody takes the heavy crude, and 50% of the world's crude is heavy, we will have won a pretty big victory in terms of reducing our use of this product.